6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I am the captain of this hot mess of a ship. I am an adult child of an alcoholic and dysfunctional family. And I created this podcast because there are millions of people out there who don't realize that the recurring issues that they're encountering in life, whether that is in romance, at work, in friendship, in parenting, is actually a result of their unresolved childhood wounds. So this is where we talk about what the hell to do about that. So welcome aboard. We curse here. You've been warned. I'm an acquired taste. You've been warned. And today, folks, we are going back into the adult child vault to revisit one of my favorite guests today, and that is Dr. Kirk Honda. He is a psychologist. He is the face behind the hugely successful YouTube channel, Psychology in Seattle, where he covers everything from your favorite reality TV shows like 90 Day Fiancés to serial killers to cults to hard-hitting deep dives into a variety of mental health topics like personality disorders. And so I have gone through his two episodes that we've had him on here on the pod and pulled my favorite portions from those. So we are talking about his views and therapeutic approach on treating complex trauma. We are talking about his missteps early in his career as a therapist when working with people with childhood trauma. We are talking about repressed memories. We are talking about common misconceptions about personality disorders. We are talking about, is it borderline, CPTSD, or both? And does it even matter? And then we are having a lengthy and fascinating discussion about his professional experience in working with those with narcissistic personality disorders, answering questions like, is it possible for a therapist to get through to a narcissist and to get a narcissist to see and change their ways? So let's get on with the damn show, folks. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you Need to Damn the Join Shit Show. This is my online support community where I host 4 weekly support groups where there are a minimum of 6 weekly support groups a week where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. Every Saturday, I post an episode, Shit Show Saturday, where you either get to hear a portion of a recording of one of our support groups or you'll get to hear an interview with one of our fellow members. This is a support community at your fingertips, in your back pocket, available to you 24/7 through our app. And this is relational trauma. The core wound, the core issue of an adult child is relational trauma. And we heal relational trauma through safe relationships. And this is a place where you can do so for less than $1 a day. So how about you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, how about we do something about that today? How about we damn the join? You can quit after a month, okay? So see the link in the show notes, or you can go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow next. Give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at adultchildpod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, 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 give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. Okay, one thing I wanted to ask you about. So this was a video that you did back in probably almost a year ago, but you were just answering listener questions and somebody was asking about complex trauma in adulthood. But one thing that I thought was really interesting that you said was that you're like, I'd like to do more of a deep dive on this because I feel like the information, especially like on online discussions, is all over the place and that you wanted to look more into the research. And I'm curious if since then you've discovered anything.
Well, I've certainly read a lot of the research and the clinical literature regarding complex PTSD and complex trauma, but in order to make an authoritative, or in order for me to speak from authority as an expert, I want to really absorb a lot of the clinical literature and the research more so than I have over the years. So there's that. But yeah,
particular do you mean that, like, it's all over the place? What are the inconsistencies that you're seeing?
Yeah, I see people using the term complex PTSD or complex trauma to refer to situations in which clinically we wouldn't necessarily use it. It seems to be broadening.
Okay.
And I think that it's a result of a couple of things. One is that in my field, been working really hard to try to raise awareness about psychology and about trauma for decades. And it felt like we were fighting an uphill battle. But then in the last 5 years, maybe a little bit longer, especially during the pandemic, we crested that hill, and all of a sudden seems like the general public is aware of a lot of important things, which is great. A lot of people are getting help. A lot of people are being validated. Celebrities are coming forward with trauma and going to therapy and all sorts of things. The downside is that, which I hadn't predicted, that when you give tools to the general public, you're going to see the general public kind of run away with it and misinterpret it. Mm. So that's one. Not similar things with gaslighting and narcissism, that kind of thing. On the other side, there are people who are suffering legitimately, but their concept hasn't been advertised enough, talked about enough. Mm-hmm. And so they will, in the absence of any validating concept, they'll latch on to a concept that is as close as they can find one. And then the definition becomes more broad from there. Trauma bonding is another term. There's all sorts of terms that people will latch on to for legitimate reasons. But like an example would be,
What would be an example of something that you do see as being referred to as complex trauma that you wouldn't necessarily think is?
Yeah. Like if someone was, I don't know if this is an actual example because I hadn't prepared for this, but I would imagine I've seen things like someone online, maybe in a TikTok video, talking about how their boss gave them complex trauma or something. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's a real example, but I would imagine that things like that are being said. And it's possible. I'm not going to say that it's impossible, but it's not likely that clinically we would refer to it as complex trauma or even trauma with necessarily.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just the, I don't know. I feel like it's still such a battle, even just to explain to people. I think a lot of people still don't even comprehend like how on the opposite end of it, like I'll still talk to people and they won't understand, like, how did you experience complex trauma? How is it trauma just growing up in an alcoholic home when you didn't endure like physical or sexual abuse? Or like, I'll get comments like, but your family was like financially well off, so how could you have experienced trauma?
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was something that I learned firsthand. I would have clients from all over the socioeconomic spectrum with the exact same problems. Mm-hmm. They would manifest a little differently. Like the richer kids would be dealing other kinds of drugs, mm-hmm. like X or stuff like that. Whereas the kids from the more marginalized neighborhoods would be dealing other kinds of substances. But the fights were the same and the complaints were the same and the traumas were the same. Yeah.
When you're working with individuals treating complex PTSD and the impacts of childhood, do you do any inner child work or parts work?
It depends on what you mean, but generally speaking, yeah, but I don't necessarily frame it that way.
Uh-huh.
Certainly with parts work as a formal activity, I will do occasionally, but more generally, yeah, it's a worthy model to explore for all of us in therapy and otherwise about like that we have different sides to us, different conflicting dynamics. And then certainly I will refer to, not necessarily using that phrase, but the idea that people have a, one way of looking at it is that we don't necessarily have an inner child, but that when you ask someone to think about their inner child, they give themselves permission to be vulnerable in a way that they had to forego because of trauma, usually around 10 or 13 or something. People without even being traumatized will start to shame themselves for having emotions. You know, when we're 2 years old, hopefully we're still not absorbing the kind of shame about emotion. And so we will just have spontaneous emotions and we're not shaming ourselves, hopefully, because we're not being shamed from the outside. I mean, certainly there are two-year-olds who are being shamed, but the average person isn't necessarily being shamed too much. And so if I ask someone to think about the inner child or to take care of their inner child, then it helps people to move past that cultural stigma around emotion.
Another thing I've heard you discuss is when you initially started practicing working with individuals and thinking that you knew about trauma, but maybe not to the extent, obviously, that you do now. And that, I don't know what word you use. I don't know if you use triggering or what, but basically that you were having patients not come back and you realized that maybe you weren't being as effective as possible. Could you touch upon that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was being harmful. Mm-hmm. I was trained and influenced from the outside in a way such that I didn't know a critical reality of the science regarding the brain and trauma, that if people have legit PTSD, because you can be traumatized in the broader term of the word trauma clinically and not develop PTSD or mm-hmm. complex PTSD or some other related thing, like there are related personality disorders. But for those who do have those physiological and also personality reactions to the trauma that they had years and years ago, if you just go headlong into having them recall the memories of trauma, mm-hmm. although there's a little bit of helpfulness that's happening, the amount of distress mm-hmm. they will experience from the exposure of something that they, because a hallmark of PTSD is to avoid the memories. And mm-hmm. there's good reasons why they avoid, because when they remember or they're reminded of the memory, they have massive spikes in distress and possible dissociation. And then from those like chronic spikes in stress, people will become a version of depressed. They will avoid a lot of things in life. They might even avoid opening up. They'll shame themselves. They'll avoid being close to others. The syndrome of PTSD all stems from that spike in the stress that happens over time. Mm-hmm. And so it might seem like the right thing to do is to have people talk about their traumas. It is a trope at some point. It's like the stereotypical therapy session is someone talks about their traumas. And I was actually trained to lean into that. But for people who had actual, and so for many of my clients, that was fine. They could talk about their traumas because they didn't have PTSD, and then it would work out okay because it would be validating and processing all the good things of therapy. But for people who have PTSD, they can have such a spike that it'll either just turn them off to therapy or it'll throw them into like 3 months of symptoms that could even lead to suicide, by the way. And they're like, therapy sucks because it makes me feel worse. I feel worse about going to therapy. And so there have to be a lot of measures taken by experts in PTSD and complex PTSD before you even begin to talk about your traumas. And that could take 5 weeks or it could take 5 years. It really just depends on the client and the course of therapy and whatnot.
What was your process in realizing that you were being harmful? Like, how did that come about?
Well, I started noticing that there was one particular client that was very noticeable, that I was working with her for years and we had a really great relationship and she was a pretty easygoing person. And we had been through some, because it started out as family therapy with her kids mm-hmm. who were were acting out a lot. And there's a lot of ups and downs through therapy. We'd been through a lot of trials. And so it wasn't like our relationship hadn't been tested before. And then she sits down one session and she says, there's something about my childhood that I've been avoiding talking about that I've never told anybody. And I feel like it's time I tell you. And at the time, I remember exactly where I was and where I was sitting, the office, and that it was sunny out. And I remember thinking, this is the golden...
Profound!
Yeah, this is where all therapists want to eventually get to. It's the fruit of one's labor. And she, you know, so she went into a difficult childhood, early childhood story, and it felt good. And she was processing it well. And I was right there with her and the session ended well. And then she canceled somehow. I don't remember how exactly the next session. And I literally never heard from her again. And I thought,
to this day?
Yeah. And that doesn't happen. That my sort of practice, that's not normal. So it always perplexed me. And I even have a gift from her on my wall behind me. You can't really see it from her, but she, on the way up to my office, I had this Japanese maple tree and she had taken these leaves one day on the way home and actually had dried them and pressed them and put them into this frame. And it was a very special thing. And so it always plagued me. I was like, what happened there? That's not a pleasant thing for therapist.
Especially somebody you've been working with for so long.
Yeah. And I then later, when I had future mentors and would have future exposure to the literature, I started to absorb more information and the science and how actual exposure, prolonged exposure therapy works and the principles regarding that within behaviorism. And again, I had a mentor that had done this work before. And so it takes a lot. It's complicated. There's a lot of details. Every client is different. And then with that mentor, I had clients who had PTSD and complex PTSD. And as I was treating them, although I had newly acquired the science and understood it, applying it is actually really complicated. And so working with the mentor and trial and error through that whole thing for years, eventually I concluded that in the past I was led astray and had harmed a client and maybe others.
In a do-over, how do you think you would have approached that? Like when she said that, I have something I need to tell you that I've never told anyone before.
Yeah. Well, in a really small nutshell, what I will say is that I need to make sure that the client understands their distress level, that they can communicate it to me, that they understand it right away, and that they can, and that they have an array of
tools,
effective tools to reduce their distress in the moment, in session and out of session. Because as we go into exposure throughout the week, they're going to have spikes of distress because they're starting to re-remember all these things. And whether they're at work or at home or at the store and they're being triggered, they need to have things available to them right then that can reduce their distress level. Because if they spike on a scale from 1 to 10 beyond like a 6 or a 7, then we're actually doing more harm than good, because every time you go through that distress, it just makes the trauma more ingrained in the physiology. So for some people, that might take 5 weeks. They might have already done a lot of emotional work or awareness. But for some people, they're lost when it comes to emotions. They've never been aware of any emotion, literally, you know, because of the trauma. And so it could take 5 years just to begin to, one, know your emotions, and two, be able to control them effectively.
What are some good ways for someone to suss out whether somebody, a therapist, is like aware enough to treat complex trauma?
There isn't. Mm-hmm. There isn't an effective way, because at least in the typical ways people will vet therapists, because even if someone says they're trauma informed or mm-hmm. they're a expert in PTSD, that I would say is a 50-50 chance they know what they're doing. Also, even if they know, they won't necessarily know how to use it. Like I said, it's complicated. It's one of those things that seems like therapists would just learn and know, but it's really a specialized area. Because mm-hmm. the other thing, you have to understand dissociation. You have to know how to detect it, because clients, people don't typically know they're dissociating. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to, it's not easy, and you have to manage dissociation because of some, anyway. So the one thing I would recommend people do is they call them or email them, or where there's a back and forth, and they say, if someone comes into your office and has trauma or PTSD, what do you do? And so if you hear them lay out a version of what I'm saying, there's a greater chance that they know what they're doing. But if they don't have any kind of, if they just say like, well, we'll talk about your trauma, then I would steer
run
clear.
For the hills.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't necessarily run for the hills, but I would really try hard to find someone that exhibited expertise in this area. Yeah.
Yeah. I would think too, an understanding of like family systems is also really important, and code. There's just so many things. And like, yeah. Like you said, the last time we were on, like, there's only so much you can learn in school, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah. There's so many things. I've been living and breathing this topic since 1995. And as a therapist, I've 2 masters and a doctorate. I've been working this whole time. I've been a professor. When you teach it, you got to really know it. And when you're a professor, you're with all these other academics, and you know, you're in the mix all the time. Your friends are also clinicians. So you're at the bar at midnight and you're talking about psychology topics. Then I start a podcast. So, and now I have family members that work for the podcast. So we talk about, so I live this whole thing and I'm still in the dark or not fully aware of the vast majority of topics within psychology. It's just too big.
Mm-hmm. The first video that I saw you on with Alita was you were discussing repressed memories and specifically related to the Manson stuff, and I guess a little bit depth be heard. So most of the people listening are, you know, have endured complex trauma and are suffering from complex PTSD. And it's something that comes up a lot. You know, a lot of people have large gaps in their memories, or they don't, you know, remember their childhood, or they have memories that come to the surface. And so would love to kind of dig into that with you some. So the first question would be, should somebody be trying to open up Pandora's box, or is it just best to just let things come to the surface naturally?
Yeah, it's a good question. It depends on what's below the surface and the amount of PTSD and the amount of treatment, the amount of self-awareness, emotional regulation support. It's a bit of a risk, not a bit, it's a huge risk for people to dive into their trauma narratives and awareness of memories without it, if they have PTSD. Well, so much to say. Okay. Well, let's say you have someone who knows they've been through some stuff, but they also know that they haven't really concentrated on recalling specific events, and they tend to avoid it because they just always have done that, or
they're scared.
What was that?
They're scared.
Yeah, they're scared of what it would mean if they did remember it, or, you know, because there's a lot of implications. If you pull up those memories, it might compel you to confront your parents, and maybe you want to preserve some connection with them, or it would cause waves or whatever. So there's a lot of consequences, but I think most important is that, and I didn't know this when I was first starting out my career, it took me a while to figure this out, or kind of learn the hard way, unfortunately, is that when people have trauma, an ongoing complex trauma, a lot of them will develop PTSD, which is a neurological condition. It's not like something you just decide upon. It's something that actually changes the way the brain is oriented. And the brain has learned to not go to anything that will remind them of the trauma, because when that happens, they have a severe spike in distress mm-hmm. and panic. And this is essentially the central feature of PTSD. And so when people are in the very beginning stages of awareness and they are wondering, should I start to go down this road? You really should be talking with a trauma specialist, because there's a chance you could actually hurt yourself mm-hmm. by diving into even just the first layer of memories, and you could trigger a massive dissociative PTSD, depressive, anxious reaction that could harm you. So what I do with people is we will experiment with tiny little bits of, like, one of the things that I do with people to kind of assess this is, well, one, I assess for PTSD. And then if that's present, then I would say, okay, what does it feel like to think about thinking about remembering the memories? You know, like, really distance yourself. Like, don't remember the memories, but what does it feel like to think about possibly in the future thinking about the memories? For people that have a legit PTSD that's at risk of being triggered, just that question alone will cause them massive amounts of distress, because the brain has learned to distance itself. Whereas other people that don't really have that sensitivity or that risk, they'll say, like, well, it's not, I'm not excited to remember those things, but you know, I'm up for it. And I'll ask, you know, do you feel any distress in your body and your torso right now? And they'll say, like, well, no, not, it's more just like sadness, I guess. So it requires a lot of emotional awareness, a lot of exploration, a lot of tailored treatment with people. So it can be very delicate, and it can take years with people.
I guess it's kind of similar in the sense, as it relates to EMDR, if you're using that to look at childhood stuff, the preparatory work required before you actually start the EMDR, you know, that requires a lot more, you know, preparatory work and, you know, getting coping skills, or if not, it could really backfire. Mm-hmm. Right?
100%. So EMDR is one, it is but one form of mm-hmm. trauma treatment. We have mm-hmm. CBT and prolonged exposure, general prolonged exposure. That's what I use. And the key is that everyone is at a different point when they embark on the path to recovering from PTSD. Some people are ready and able to go into their trauma narratives, either through EMDR or through verbally discussing them in CBT and prolonged exposure. And some people are far from ready. It could take them. I've worked with people who I work on that preparatory phase you're referring to for 5 to 10 years, because their life is so out of control. The amount of PTSD reactivity is so severe. The risk of harming themselves to go into the narratives is so high. Some people don't, because of their traumas, they don't even know their emotions, because a big part of knowing whether or not you're okay to go into your trauma narratives, either internally or externally, meaning you think about it, EMDR, you say it out loud in prolonged exposure, is being able to report to me, the trauma specialist, are you feeling distress? Well, some people, they don't even know what feelings they're feeling, because mm-hmm. they were never allowed to have their feelings growing up. And so we have to start from the fundamentals. Like, let's actually work for 5 years on getting you connected with your body, your torso, your emotions, your needs, so that you can even answer the question, how are you feeling when you think about talking about your trauma narratives?
So other than looking for kind of the right answer, when you're asking, how do you feel about talking about trauma, or, you know, looking at this stuff, what would be some other key indicators that would show you that somebody's really ready to dive into it more deeply?
If they have already talked about it in the past or journaled about it or something, and it didn't
totally spin out.
Yeah, it didn't moderately to severely ruin their life for a week. Yeah.
Could you explain the difference of what the hell's going on in the brain? So I obviously have complex PTSD. So I have these unprocessed emotions or memories that are being stored in my limbic system. What is the difference between that and a repressed memory as it relates to the brain? Or is there not a difference?
Yeah, it's a really complicated question, a good question, one that we're still trying to refine in terms, because we don't really have a refined ability to measure what the brain is doing. It's like we're looking at the Earth from a million miles away, and we're like, well, I can kind of see maybe an ocean there. You know, we can't get on the ground in terms of the brain because it's too complicated. One day, after we're dead, probably we'll be able to do that. But generally speaking, what I can say is that memory, we tend to think of memory as a binary. It's like you either remember it or you don't. Mm-hmm. But that's really not how memory is. And we also tend to think about memories as fixed. Like when something happens, we quote unquote record a memory and then it just becomes that memory. But what memory is a set of associations. And every time we recall it, we pull together dozens of associations to reconstruct the memory and the narrative that we can speak. Mm. And then as we're speaking it, we're probably distorting it to some extent. And we're remembering the fact every time we recall something, we're recording it again. So memories are really quite malleable in that way. But to address what you're saying is that when people have knowledge, like, well, I know I've been through a lot of stuff, and I also know that I don't want to remember. So we have to define repressed memory. So for some people, they will use this very rigid definition, which is the kind of classical Freudian definition. But even Freud didn't really use it in this way, but it's sort of the way it's understood as classical Freudian, is that you go through a difficult experience and your brain subconsciously, you know, pushes the memory underneath your conscious awareness. Mm-hmm. And then through psychoanalysis, it can, you know, be unearthed, and then you can have catharsis and recover in that way. And certainly that can happen, you know, certainly there are documented cases where that can happen. But another form, which is more common, really, which is, I think, what you're referring to is, well, let me ask you. So, let's not do this right now, but say you were to really concentrate and kind of walk down memory lane in your mind, say it out loud, and might you find memories at the end of, say, you know, 5-10 hours of exploration while you're talking out loud? Might you find memories you're like, oh, I've totally forgot about that, or that one detail, you know, might that happen to you?
Yeah. But I was more so talking about people that literally it's completely repressed. Like they have no memory of it at all. It's kind of what I meant more so.
Okay. Well, yeah. So again, we have to even define that, because one example is you have, say, a 13-year-old that goes through a traumatic sexual abuse experience. Mm-hmm. And they, while it's happening, are not really even trying to pay attention to what's happening because they're powerless and they don't want to. Mm-hmm. They're just trying to check out. It's like, well,
yeah, they disassociate, or they, yeah, go into.
Yeah, whether it's full blown pathological dissociation or just like trying to just get through it, you know, there's different forms of it. But and then right afterwards, they don't want to think about it. Mm-hmm. And they also don't have anyone to talk to mm-hmm. about it with, because they don't think anyone will hear them or something. And so day one after the event to the time they are thinking about this at age 35, they've never thought about it. They've never recalled it. Every time something hinted at it, they instantly like pushed it away. So if you ask them, were you assaulted when you were 13? they would say, no. I'd say, you know, are you sure? Do you have any memories of that? They'd say, no. They would have no memory, no access to that memory, because memory, you know, the fact there's so many things that happened to us when we were 13, right? There's like a billion little moments that happened to us when we're 13. Why do we remember like the 30 things that happened to us when we were 13? Well, it's because we recalled them later. We saw a picture, we told a story, something happened later. Like, remember that time when that, or you remember, oh, I remember that teacher. When we recall, it solidifies the memory so that we can have better access to it later. If you never consciously recall something after an event, even if it's a big deal, like being assaulted, your ready access to that memory is actually extremely limited. You might actually never be able to have access to it. But if you start going down a road where you start thinking, well, I do remember being kind of distressed, and then say I asked a question like, well, do you think you might have been assaulted at some point in your life? You know, might that have happened? And I have to be careful because I can't, you know, there are risks of inserting memories, which is a whole other thing with repressed memories.
Yes, yes.
But if I avoid the pitfalls of inserting memories and just there's a way to do that, then the person might go, well, I do kind of remember something happening, but I also remember like I didn't want to really think about it. And, you know, I don't know if I want to think about it right now. You know, they might have that reaction, like, I'm pretty sure something happened when I was 13, now that I think about it, but I don't want to think about it because they, you know, they have so much distress. So that's one form, but there's, you know, probably 50 other profiles scenarios I could tell you that,
yeah,
that one might call repressed memory, but isn't doesn't adhere to the rigid definition that people often attack, because that's what's happening. You know, people say there's no such thing as repressed memories. And it's like, well, what do we mean by repressed memory exactly?
Okay. Next question. Another thing. So when we talk about borderline versus complex PTSD, one time I Googled it, I was going to make a video about it for like TikTok or Instagram. And a few of the articles I read were saying that the difference is that people with borderline have a much greater fear of abandonment than people with complex PTSD. And that also sounded like bullshit to me. How would you say the difference is? What would you say the difference is?
Well, it depends on the definition, you know, because when we're talking about things like the difference between oxygen and nitrogen, these are discrete, concrete chemical realities that you can actually answer the question to. But when we're trying to determine the difference between PTSD, complex PTSD, and borderline, and what distinctly is different about them,
in your opinion,
it depends on, well, I don't really care, because when I treat people, I don't really care what label we apply to it. It's more, even if I do solidly determine they have one of these things, everyone who has one of these things is different. So it doesn't really matter to me. If someone wanted to say, well, I have complex PTSD because online I read that this and that, like, I don't argue with them. I don't care, because it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. As long as we're working on what they want to work on and helping them recover, it doesn't matter what we call it. So, but the consensus, at least that's emerging in the literature, I think, is that PTSD, complex PTSD, and borderline are all on a spectrum, that there's a set of symptoms that are, you know, everyone with complex PTSD, people with complex PTSD tend to have all the symptoms of PTSD plus a few more symptoms. And people with borderline have all the symptoms of complex PTSD plus some additional symptoms. So from my memory in the literature, what they're saying as a difference between borderline and complex PTSD is that with borderline, there's more, if I remember right, more emptiness feelings, more demoralization. I don't know. I'd have to look it up. But really, if people argue about this sort of stuff online, I'm like, just move forward and get the help you need. Don't worry about what it's called. Unless you're a researcher and you're in the weeds about making these distinctions, or you're developing the DSM definition criteria for complex PTSD, like it's irrelevant to one's life as to what you call it. Because, you know, say you take two people, both have been through a lot growing up and both have a lot of abandonment traumas, a lot of worries of being harmed by others. They don't trust other people, but they're desperate for closeness from others. And one person's like, I totally have borderline because when I read online, it feels right to me. And the other person's like, I totally have complex PTSD because when I read online, it sounds like me. The treatment is the same. There's no difference in treatment. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, generally speaking, it's the same. Now, if you go online, they'll say it's really quite different, but to the experts, the treatment is the same. You want to help people to recover from the traumas that they went through. Abandonment traumas can be really, life affecting. And when you recover from them and you also work on your schemas that you developed as a result, then, and you go through a lot of corrective experiences with, you know, secure attachments, then things tend to get better. Now, some people with borderline will not have classic or at least high levels of presentations of what we might call PTSD reactivity of distress.
Like so, emotional flashbacks, trauma responses?
Yes. Also, they tend to be just kind of constantly moderately distressed rather than having massive spikes. Mm-hmm. Some people with borderline will have very classic complex PTSD reactivity. When they're triggered, they'll just have a huge spike in distress and might even dissociate as well. So like I said, it just depends on the individual, and every client should be taken as an individual, and the therapist should tailor the treatment to that individual, regardless of what label they're using.
Well, I think my concern would be, I mean, you know your shit, but let's be honest, there's a lot of therapists out there who don't. Like, so many of us sat in therapy for years without our therapist being able to pick up on that this is childhood related, you know, that this is unresolved childhood shit. And so I guess my concern would be is if we're misdiagnosing people with borderline and therapists view that as a personality disorder that is always going to be there, you know, that I guess that's kind of my concern there is that people aren't getting better.
Yeah. Well, one, borderline is not forever necessarily. Research has shown that. So yes, the problem is there. Many therapists do not know what they're doing.
Don't even know about that. I had a friend that had got a therapist, never had even heard of ACEs.
Yeah. So, well, there are a lot of things to cover in graduate school and continuing ed. And the problem is that therapists don't know what they don't know. You go to a foot doctor, the foot doctor will say, well, I'm not a dentist, so if you ask me a question about your teeth, I could maybe take a stab at it, but you probably shouldn't talk to me. Whereas therapists are generally taught or given the model that they're supposed to be able to do everything. And it unless you really dedicate your life to learning all the topics, you essentially become a dentist and a foot doctor and a cardiologist, then you probably should get to know what you don't know and realize that you shouldn't be talking about stuff you don't know what you're saying. And so it's a problem for sure. But that's why I say when people are wanting proper treatment for trauma, that they should find a specialist and quiz them beforehand. Just be like, so prove to me that you're an actual specialist, because some people will advertise themselves as trauma specialists, but they have really no sophistication about how to treat people. So you would want to, you have to do your own homework to at least get a primer on what a therapist, at least in the area of what they should be saying, that could prove to you that they actually are an expert. Having said that, even if you search your community for 6 months, you might not even find someone that has an open spot in that category, which is a whole other problem. So
exactly.
I'm not saying it's easy.
No, it seems impossible from what I'm hearing.
It's not impossible. I mean, there are, if you keep looking, that'll raise your chances of finding that person. But I understand the frustration. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And obviously this could just be like my bias and just based off, you know, the top subject matter that I cover, but it just seems to me, and in my opinion, that so much of our shit is rooted in childhood, that it really should be something that's really covered in like adverse childhood experiences. I feel like that is something that every damn, I understand that, you know, a podiatrist can't be a plastic surgeon, but I mean, to me, it just seems like that subject matter is so damn important for anybody to know.
Yes, but you'd be surprised how many other critical topics mm-hmm. are also on the list. But and you have some people that just don't think that that topic is actually important. You know, there's whole schools of thought that say that talking about the past is completely useless. In fact, it's problem oriented thinking. It's this old, you know, throwback to stupid Freudian
rumination.
Yeah. And that isn't rational or scientifically based, but you know, there are certain, I guess you could say, religious movements ish, you know what I mean? Like charismatic people will emerge and pull everyone towards them. And so, yeah, it's a troubling landscape.
How important is it that the therapist has done their own work on their own shit?
Extremely. And any therapist that avoids that is irresponsible in a whole variety of ways. Yeah. Every good therapist I know is in therapy half their lives, even if there's not any pressing matter. You know, I've been through many years of therapy, and but it's not just therapy. It's really an ongoing commitment to self-awareness around your own issues, countertransference, your own growth, and how you operate, your own reactivity. Yeah, it's that's been known since Freud's time. Freud actually introduced that idea of countertransference and making sure that you're not harming your patients through your own issues. That's been well known for a long time, but some people avoid it for sure.
Okay, so now to pivot over to narcissism and narcissistic relationships, what do you think are the biggest misconceptions for the general public at large about narcissism?
All right, shit show ladies. Have you ever had those days where everything just feels so much damn harder than normal and you can't figure out why? I already know the answer to that question is yes. And boy, have I definitely had more than my fair share of those days and totally get just how frustrating this can be. But recently, I've learned that sometimes it's not just stress, lack of sleep, a dysregulated nervous system. It could also be my hormones at play. And that is where Happy Mammoth comes in. They offer a free 2-minute quiz that can help you uncover the root cause of your hormonal symptoms. It's super easy. Any shit show can do it. Just answer a few questions about what you've been going through and where you're at in life. After taking this quiz, you'll get personalized recommendations to help balance your hormones and start feeling better. So I took this hormone quiz myself. The quiz suggested that my body may be overloaded with estrogen, which is affecting me in all kinds of ways. And one of the recommendations that I got was to start taking Hormone Harmony, which helps with bloating, chronic fatigue, weight gain, mood swings, and more. And after adding it to my routine, I've definitely noticed a difference. Now, taking care of your hormones isn't just about feeling good right now. It's also about investing in our healing journey. And so by taking this quiz, you'll learn more about your hormone balance, which will allow you to start making small, intentional changes to support you on this healing journey. Whether it's the Hormone Harmony or another Happy Mammoth product, the quiz helps guide you towards solutions that work specifically for you. So if you're ready to start feeling like yourself again, head over to happymammoth.com and take their free 2-minute hormone quiz today to find out the ultimate answer to your stubborn hormonal issues. And for a limited time, you can also get 15% off your entire first order with my code ADULTCHILD at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ADULTCHILD for 15% off today.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
To start off.
So I don't know exactly how, I could imagine how, but through the awareness of psychology that I was talking about earlier, people became aware of this clinical term called narcissism. And people are now seemingly using it
to describe everyone.
But specifically anyone who they, I think what they're using it for is a replacement word for harmful or abusive or toxic. And it's getting weirder. Like in the beginning, when I first started hearing people using it wrongly, they were using it as a replacement for a psychopath or an antisocial personality spectrum individual, which isn't super far from the mark. It's still drastically wrong, but at least it's in the ballpark, and they were only using it for like the severe cases. I was watching 90 Day Fiancé not too long ago, and one of the individuals was calling their husband narcissistic, and the context, which I'm not really remembering, but it was so, I was like, huh? It almost seemed like she was using it to refer to someone who just wasn't a good husband or something. It wasn't even related to self-centeredness or arrogance or being harmful necessarily. I just thought like, wow, so we're just using narcissistic or you're a narcissist to refer to literally anybody that you don't
like.
We
don't like.
Yeah. You know, like, I don't like pickles. They're narcissistic. And like, huh? Like, wow. And I will have students now who will come into my program, and I have to deprogram them from having been quote unquote educated about topics like this. And it's so annoying. In the past, it was hard because they hadn't even heard of the term, but I'd rather go back there because now I have to deconstruct the whole, I can't start from the beginning. I have to start from way back to rework all this stuff. And I worry because there's one research shows that among many topics, narcissism is not well understood among clinicians. And a lot of clinicians don't understand that they don't understand it, because it's really personality disorders in general are like super complicated. And I worry that, I think I've seen evidence of this, that there's a lot of therapists online like myself, but there's a lot of novice clinicians online who are just saying shit about narcissism and they don't know what they're talking about. So when you have clinicians talking to other clinicians online, then that's when things start to, because who else defines these things other than clinicians? And then you have all the experts who aren't necessarily online. I'm one of the few online that actually, I'm one of the few people that I would consider to be an expert, not to pat myself on the back, but it's a specialty of mine, who actually is online. So I worry that in 10 years, 99% of people and clinicians won't even understand what it means. It's a useful concept is the thing.
No,
but it's
kidding.
It's a very useful, when you understand it, it's a very useful construct, but it's specific and being misused. Yeah.
It's concerning if you're seeing practitioners talking to other practitioners and giving false information, like in an online forum. That's really disturbing.
Yeah. And, you know, if we're just like, well, it's just a word, it's just pedantic, it points to a larger problem of, I would just imagine if you were new to the field and you're just trying to absorb everything you can about psychology and you're on TikTok for at least an hour a day, I would imagine that if I were in those shoes, I would be going down roads in which good number of notions or wisdoms or understandings would influence me in a way that would actually lead to me harming clients. Like someone come, an individual comes into my office and starts complaining about her husband. And I'm just like, oh, I know this. He's a narcissist. And so you need to divorce him, or, you know, and maybe even other clinicians told me to do that stuff. So it is worrisome.
Well, I think the problem is like how much the word is rewarded as far as like in search engines. And I talk to people, it's like people might not be narcissism experts, but that's their videos on that are what are getting the hits.
Right. Yes. So,
okay. Well, what percentage of the population is it, did they say, has NPD?
I think it's like 2%. It depends on how you define it in the study, but okay. Most studies,
how would it vary? Like how are there big differences in how the personality disorder is being defined? If you're looking at actual like psychological studies and literature?
Well, I will. Yeah. So in the studies, sometimes they will broaden it, particularly when they're talking about general narcissism, that that's a whole other topic in that. You might hear studies that say like people are more narcissistic today than they were 30 years ago. They're not talking about narcissistic personality disorder. They're talking about something that actually is dubious because it could literally be a sign that people have more self-esteem now in a mm-hmm. good way than 30 years ago. And you wouldn't frame that as being narcissistic, but so that's a whole other topic. I can't remember the main researcher's name. But when it comes to trying to actually find, you know, NPD, the prevalence in society, sometimes it comes down to like, how do you ask the questions? How much do we allow other people to make calls about other people? If you're asking, you know, how many narcissistic people do? So there's a lot of different methods, but generally speaking, when you actually do pretty rigorous assessments of individuals that are expensive, it takes a long time. Yeah, it's about 2%.
And did they have to meet all of the criteria, or is it like, what is it, like 5 of 7, or how many?
I don't know. I don't remember the specific in terms of the DSM language, but yeah, it's a set. But generally speaking, what clinicians, experts will say is that the criteria and the whatever 5 of 7 is just there as a way to provide some quote unquote scientific threshold, because otherwise it's hard to know if people are all following the same rules. But generally what we would say is that someone has developed a schema in which deep down they believe that they are nothing, that they are worthless, shameful, just irrelevant creatures deep down. But their solution, their defense is to delude themselves and others that not only are they worthy, but they're superior. And they need that to be true, because even if everyone else believes that they're superior, but they know that they're not, they will crumble. So a lot of their efforts to make sure everyone understands that they're superior, maybe even making other people inferior, is because that's evidence that they are worthwhile. They're not constantly trying to make everyone inferior just because they want to. They're doing it because every minute of every day, depending on the severity of it, they're trying to reassure themselves that they're okay. But they know they're running on a treadmill away from a monster, and they're never getting far away from it.
How much consciousness is there of that?
Zero.
Very little? Yeah, none.
Personality disorders without treatment, the hallmark is that they lack insight. Yeah.
So then when we look at it really being shame-based and them thinking that they're nothing, obviously there's like psychological theory, but have there been experiences where they've, because the defenses are so strong and they have no awareness, but have there been instances where like either through like hypnosis or breaking down where they've actually been able to identify that within the person, or is that just theory?
Are you asking
about the being truly shame-based and feeling like they're deep down inside feeling like they're nothing?
Yeah, it's not hard to find.
Surmise.
Because for people who have the legit disorder, mm-hmm. if they're being honest or you're close enough to them, you will see they're not doing well. Like if when they're out, like a common story is that you'll have a husband who at work and in the world is acting out the superiority and might even be convincing everyone that they're awesome and perfect and wonderful and they've achieved so much and might even believe that their home life is perfect, all this kind of stuff. But the wife will tell you that he is not secure. Mm-hmm. In fact, when things go wrong at work, which happens frequently, he'll come home and he will just be in the worst mood, or he'll even go into the bathroom and cry for like 5 hours or scream at everyone in the house. You know, he's not doing well. Mm-hmm. And so that's one profile, a common profile that I've treated many times. So yeah, it's not hard to find evidence that the person is suffering from something.
Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts on people that think that they can essentially be healed?
Yeah, personality disorders, aside from antisocial, potentially all can be improved regarding symptoms. And the path is through awareness and corrective experiences, in my opinion. And people with narcissistic personality disorder, even antisocial psychopathy, but yeah, absolutely with narcissism, same with borderline, same with paranoid, all the personality disorders, if the person is ready and the therapist is good enough and the relationship is strong enough and the person has enough funding to have long-term therapy and there's enough going well enough in their life that they're not in constant crisis, then self-awareness is likely. And then long-term with corrective experiences, and the corrective experience for the person with narcissism, ironically, is that they're made to feel special, but not because of something they achieved, but just because of who they are on the inside. Also, they have to get in connection with themselves, which because of their early neglect, never achieved. But yeah, I've treated people with narcissistic personalities. It's not easy.
What is it, do you think, gets somebody to that place of willingness?
Commonly, in my experience, their life will
completely implode.
Yeah, they're like a common story is you'll have a woman who is skating through life. Things are going okay. And if you asked her, she would say things are not only going well, but everything's going perfectly. Meanwhile, her marriage is going poorly over time. Her spouse is trying to assert, but it's not working. Then all of a sudden, divorce happens, comes out of the blue. And there's been a lot of fighting, but this one's bigger. And then the wife, the narcissistic person, is like, well, I don't understand. Like, I thought everything was perfect. And then the narcissistic person can't rely on their normal defenses, because as the constant onslaught of the pain of the loss or the disillusionment or the loneliness, then they can't get on top of it. Their normal defenses aren't working. And they might turn to substances. Someone might suggest they go to therapy. Their workplace might say, hey, unless you go to therapy, we're not going to keep you around, or something. And then they end up in my office. And then the work begins. It's not easy, though, because they're not sitting down in my office saying, I suffer from narcissistic personality disorder. They're just like, I just need 5 sessions to get over this hump or whatever. But yeah, it's usually something like that.
And so is part of the process of getting them, quote unquote, better, getting them to understand that they have NPD?
Yeah.
Is that, yeah. And
I mean, how... I don't know if I always use that, because narcissistic personality disorder, the phrase, the label is specific to the DSM and, you know, the research literature, but not every clinician or clinical piece of literature uses that exact phrase. You know, that phrase was developed by the authors of the DSM mm-hmm. in relation to a lot of literature that's been around for a long time. So I don't necessarily have to say that, but I will. Yeah, because I tell them don't Google it. I might show them in the DSM, this is what's going on. It might take years to get there.
To get them to see it, or before you'd even bring that terminology up.
Yeah, it might take years. It takes me months even to be confident that the label applies anyway, because personality disorders take a long time to assess.
And so do you feel like you can be helpful to them in those first few months when you're trying to get an idea of of what it actually is going on with somebody who's suffering from a personality disorder, do you feel like they're getting much out of it, the process?
Yeah, depends. But yeah, people with narcissistic personality disorder, they're not aliens. They have the same kind of humanity that everyone else does. And they care and don't want their life to go down the tubes. And they also love their spouse, contrary to what the internet will say, and don't want to lose them. Or they also probably know that they're a little arrogant and a little braggy. And they don't want to do that to other people. But yeah, I can think of cases in which people will have made some changes in their life pretty quickly. But 99% of the time, those changes are temporary because they're in a crisis. And so I'm not thinking, wow, this is permanent. I'm thinking this is the honeymoon period. And so I have to capitalize on that. And a frequent thing that I'll say to people with NPD and therapy is I will say, at some point, you will think that you don't need therapy anymore. And it's very self-serving of me to say, you probably do need therapy, but it's a hallmark of your schema, because people with narcissistic personality disorder, what's working against them is that due to their early childhood experiences, they were forced to be independent way too early. And so they think that the default mode in life is pathological independence. Yeah. And when their defenses kick in, they're like, I know more than my therapist does. But even just baseline, they're just like, yeah, I'm good. I don't need to bother anyone with my things. So when they're in that honeymoon period, I try to plant those seeds of like, you're free to leave and I'm not going to disparage you, but I'm just saying it's a hallmark of your thing that you're going to drop out at some point because things are going a little bit better. And then you're right back to where you started a year from now.
And I would imagine that even when you say that every single time, if you're working with somebody long enough, that will come up, I'm assuming, that they think they're good. And then how do you navigate that?
Yeah, you know, it's fraught because, like I said, it's very self-serving to say, I've diagnosed you as clinically wrong when you say you want to drop out of therapy with me and stop paying me money. So I will be explicit about that and very careful about any sort of pressure I put on people, but I'll phrase it in a way of saying, like, in my clinical opinion, this is what's going on. And I would predict much better things for you if we continue with this long-term work. It takes a while. You're absolutely free to leave. And I'm not going to get upset if you make that choice, and we'll start transitioning to terminate. But that's just my clinical opinion, and you can take it or leave it. Some people take it, some people leave it.
And what would be indicators that you see that somebody is getting better?
Vulnerability, and like true vulnerability. Like when they are hurt or sad or rejected or scared, they not only talk about it, which is great, but they also will emote it. Like their husband hurts their feelings emotionally. Like he, I don't know. He was like, a common narcissistic kind of trigger would be that you're at a dinner party. And let's say the wife, she's narcissistic and the husband is paying too much attention to other people or isn't complimenting her enough or something. And it's really because there's other people, there's eyes on her, self-conscious. And then on the way home, instead of giving him the cold shoulder or putting him down, she cries. She just says, when you were doing that, I don't know if it's just my issue, but in my trigger from my early childhood, but when you were talking to other people and you weren't being there for me, it was destroying me. Again, it could be me, but I'm just telling you, like, it was so hurtful. And then crying, that is very hard for someone with NPD. I mean, it is, I can work for years and feel pretty good about how things are going and not see that for 7 years. There's such a blockage there. It's so scary because when they were 1 year of age, they were vulnerable, but no one was there.
So that's the next question. It's nature.
Yeah. No, it's nurture. Yeah.
Sorry, nurture.
I mean, nature might play a role in setting up the disposition to be pushed in that direction. You neglect a one-year-old child, you're going to see something. But maybe with some kids, they already have a leaning in the narcissistic direction, seemingly, or cluster B direction, maybe.
And would it always be, because they say most impactful is what, like 1 to 2 or 0 to 3? Like, typically, is that what we would see with this? Or could it be experiences that are granted, I don't know why it would randomly just start happening when they're 6 years old. But generally speaking, are we talking very, very, very early childhood?
Yeah, we're talking early childhood for sure. Because once you learn good skills or good enough procedures emotionally, 0 to 5, and you experience really bad things after that point, then you might see some effects for sure. I mean, you can be bullied at school and be in a good family and have long-term effects, but the kinds of effects will be different and the recovery will be different. With people with narcissistic personality disorder, they at no point in their life had ever had a chance to be vulnerable and be seen. Whereas someone who is raised well 0 to 5 and then they're treated horribly, they might have retracted from the world. That might be one defense. But when they engage in therapy, once we start to engage with them in a way that makes them feel safe enough, all of those skills and those foundations will start to show themselves. Where people with NPD, they don't have that at all. You got to start literally from the beginning with them.
So what percentage of the people that you've worked with have been people that have been in a relationship with somebody who has NPD? Would you say you've worked more so with those who have it versus those who are in a relationship with them?
What percentage of the people that I've
clientele treated, that you work with, yeah, that you've treated,
that have had NPD?
No, that you are in a relationship with somebody who has it.
Not frequent, because NPD, like I was saying earlier, is 2% of the population.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, people who have spouses with NPD are perhaps more likely to end up in therapy, but the thing is there's a lot of personality disorders, and so narcissistic personality disorder is just one that the general public is aware of, but there are far more prevalent personality disorders that clinicians are more likely to see, just on average.
Okay, well, maybe just being in a relationship with somebody who has a personality disorder in general.
Think everyone is on a spectrum of some personality disorder. That's just me.
And are they moving towards that?
Well, we've always considered personality to be a spectrum, most of us. The disorder part of it was because of the need to formalize these labels in the 50s because we needed to justify funding. So it's the whole language in the DSM is just there for that. But for 150 years, we've been describing personality, and the DSM language comes from that. Before you had the DSM, you had just psychoanalysts talking about narcissistic personality or borderline personality or obsessive compulsive personality. And it wasn't a formalized, defined thing, but then the DSM comes along. So yeah, since the beginning, it's always been considered a spectrum.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.